Finlandiya Helsinki Üniversitesi'nden Profesör Doktor Lia Heveren'in görmenin en iyi kullanılabilecek görmenin değerlendirilmesi ve hassas ölçülmesi üzerine bize çok değerli bilgiler verecektir. Kendilerini takdim ediyorum. Buyurun efendim. Az görmeyle ilgili değerlendirmeler.
Mr. Chairman, dear friends, good morning. I have been asked to, within these next 20 minutes, to discuss the most common ways of measuring low vision, techniques that are used by medical personnel, but as well by all the members of the low vision team, that means also teachers and therapists, when they get accustomed to them. When we start an assessment, what we then have to think about is why we do our assessment. We measure what kind of vision there is for the four main areas where we use vision in schools and preschool, and that is communication, asking what kind of vision there is for visual communication in this child, what kind of vision does the child have for orientation and mobility, for activities of daily living and for sustained near vision tasks like reading and writing and crafts. If the child has really poor vision, then we also remember to think about whether the child has enough vision to initiate communication, whether the child is enough aware of what is going on around him or herself. When we are dealing with very young children, please open. When we are dealing with very young children, then we have to think on all the areas of development where vision is important, and those are many. I have here just a list of the most important areas of development that we need to think upon, and those are, again, visual communication and bonding between the infant and the parents, and communication also with all the other persons who are in contact with the child. What kind of vision there is for motor development, a development of balance, a development of spatial concepts, how visual impairment affects development of object permanence, self-image, different social skills, everyday tasks, and development of language. So when measuring the different aspects of vision, we have a number of different things that we think base a question why we measure the different visual functions and how we should interpret the individual measurements. In the clinical assessment, we have a certain tradition what we do. We first look not on the sensory functions, which we usually think as vision, but first on the motor functions of the child, because we need different motor functions in order to use our eyes. So what we do is as is shown here, we first ask ourselves, does the child have one or two functioning eyes? If he has two functioning eyes, does he use them together? If he or does he use them alternatingly, or only one of the two, the other one being a lazy eye? And if the child only uses one eye, then we don't have any of the aspects of binocularity to think about. We next then assess what kind of power the child has to focus the gaze at near distances, which is called accommodation. How well the child can fixate on objects that he wants to look at, whether the fixation is stable or it's fleeing, just quickly passing the object without the child being able to fixate the gaze on the object. We also measure how well the child can use the quick movements from one fixation to the next fixation, movements called saccades, and how well the child can follow, track a moving object. If the child has two eyes and is looking at near, the eyes need to move inward. We call that convergence. So in the binocular children, children who use both eyes, we also test how well they can converge. Some of these children, and actually many of visually impaired children, have crossed eyes. And then we make a notice on that, note on that. And also many of them have nystagmus. The eyes are constantly moving, so that that will also affect the use of their eyes. The by far the most common and most important measurement still is measurement of visual acuity. And that we do with a number of different tests. The basic visual acuity test that we use is a test that we call line test. And in that test, the distance between the symbols is equal to the width of the symbols, and the distance between the different lines of the test is equal to the height of the lower line. Then we get a test that becomes narrower when we go down on the test. This is the type of test recommended by the International Council of Ophthalmology in 1989 as the basic type of visual acuity tests. And this is the test that we refer to when we talk about visual acuity. It can be based on either, I think we now have children's symbols there, the symbols that I developed several years ago. We can also use numbers, which are international, and again, the structure of the test needs to be the same. Now, some children will have problems in concentrating on so much visual information, and therefore we need simpler tests, especially when assessing children. A test where we only have five different symbols as a group can function, or does function, as a line test. As we call this test that we just spoke about, a line test. When we use the middle one, the middle symbol, as the test symbol, there is a similar interference by the other symbols around as there is in the line test. So with this test, we still can get the same kind of visual acuity values as we get with the charts. And this needs to be used in a number of cases when we have young children or children who have difficulties in concentrating on the task. Now, if this is too difficult for the child, then we need to go to using of single symbols. Whenever we just show one symbol at a time, then the task is much, much easier than if we would use a line test. And then we must remember to write down in the chart that the measurement was made with single symbol test, so that we don't overestimate the child's visual capabilities. Visual acuity measured with a single symbol quite often is 3 to 4 lines better than visual acuity measured with a line test in the visually impaired children. There are still both younger or less functioning children who do not respond even in this easy test situation. And then we have to measure their vision with after training. And for training, I have made a puzzle where we can first start with the color matching, because we have to teach the child the concepts similar and different, and related to colors, these concepts develop several months to even years before the child can play with black and white forms, which then will be the test symbols. So we start playing matching colors, and the child is then exposed to the same forms, and later will learn to match the three-dimensional forms, then match the blocks to two-dimensional forms, and then to match them smaller and smaller, getting ready to be tested formally. This may take a few days, a few hours, a few months, or a few years, depending on the child's capabilities. So this is a typical part where therapists and teachers come in vision assessment, taking care of this training part, and at the same time learning how well the child can use vision in this situation. If the child is too young or doesn't learn to respond in testing with symbols, which we call optotypes, then we can measure or assess.
These pupils should definitely be encouraged to use their vision for most learning activities. However, assessment of vision on its own is not sufficient to decide on the primary reading medium. Certain questions should be asked of family and professionals who know the child, and of course ask the child themselves. Making the initial decision as to whether to use print or braille before the child starts school involves using a variety of criteria. Koenig and Holbrook suggest that a checklist of how a child prefers to carry out a range of activities can help in this decision. For example, does the child use mainly visual or non-visual responses in the following situations? Recognition of others, initiation of reaching response, exploration of toy or object, use of visual motor or fine motor skills, interest in pictures, books, interest in scribbling or writing, identification of names or simple words. Sometimes it will be obvious that a child prefers the visual medium for near vision tasks, and then the decision is easy. If it is not clear in the very early stages, then print could be introduced while at the same time continuing to develop pre-braille skills. If a clear preference has not developed by the end of the first half of the first school year, then print reading could be emphasized with the option of providing supplemental instruction in braille reading in the future, indicated during the ongoing evaluation. Mangold and Mangold describe the primary learning medium as the one most frequently used during classroom instruction. It should allow access to the greatest variety of educational materials, both reading and writing. They outline 5 major considerations when selecting a medium. 1. Working distance from the page for both reading and writing. Does the student have enough working distance to maintain focus while writing? The greater the distance from the page, the more easily the student can maintain focus for extended periods. 2, portability of reading skills. For example, ability to read one's own handwriting, able to transfer skills using a closed-circuit television to handheld or spectacle-mounted magnifiers. 3, reading rates and accuracy. A student using the most appropriate primary learning medium will show measurable growth in reading rates as well as vocabulary and comprehension. 4, visual fatigue. This may depend on a variety of reasons, time of day, lighting, motivation. 5, interpreting assessment. Objective assessment of a student's performance is a ongoing process. First, establish what the student's primary learning medium should be, print or braille, and second, consider how to design a delivery system to meet those needs. What are some of the practicalities of all this? Children with low vision often prefer peering close, whether they can accommodate or not. If the child can accommodate, the image will be both large and sharp. If the child cannot accommodate, it will be blurred. The child will usually prefer the large blurred image rather than a small, less blurred one. Similarly, if the cause of blurring is due to impaired visual resolution or other disorders of visual perception or visual function, the child may be unable to see the details below a certain size. For these children, optical correction alone cannot help. Magnification, lighting, and training all have a part to play. For younger children in the early school stages, where print is large, letting the child go close to the work is the best solution. Providing sloping boards or stands for both reading and writing can greatly help the child's posture. Enlarging the material can help, and sometimes enlargement and adaptation is necessary. For example, in some mathematics workbooks, the child can be confused by too much information on the page. By presenting items separately, the child can cope more easily and independently. I have some examples of work which I have adapted for a pupil, and anyone who's interested can see that later. Remember the importance of good contrast, so if material is photocopied, it needs to be clear. Glare is a problem for some children. If the child does not have tinted lenses, then using coloured paper or coloured acetate overlays in pink or yellow might help. Always ask the child if it makes it better and observe as well. Bold lines on paper can help the child in both writing and number work. Illustrations may be enlarged, made bold, outlined, or simplified depending on the needs of the child. Computers, if available, offer easier and quicker access to reading and recording schoolwork. Font size, background and foreground colours, voice, print and braille output can all be tailored to the needs of the individual and the school subject. Both braille and print may be the answer for some pupils. Conclusion. As with any young life, it is not possible to know where it will go. When we are planning and delivering education for a child with low vision, we have to make sure we use all the information we can get at the time to decide on how best the child can learn in the various educational activities, whether using visual or non-visual means. We have to continue reviewing this as the child grows and the demands of the curriculum change. That way, we can hope that our children will be both successful and happy. Thank you.
Sayın Mariana Bulcumisez, çok teşekkür ediyoruz değerli görüşlerinden dolayı.